This is the sixth lecture in this particular series entitled From the Cold War to the War on Terror. And what we've been trying to do in this lecture series is explore the close, complex, intimate, and not so intimate relationships between the past and the present. We started off, as I said earlier on, in an earlier brief speech I made with Professor John Mearsheimer from the University of Chicago, and I'm absolutely delighted this evening to have my old friend John Eikenberry now at the at Princeton University. For anybody who has studied American foreign policy conceptually and empirically, historically, over the last few years, the name Eikenberry, I think, stands as close to the top as it's possible to be in a very, very competitive field. John has, in my opinion, has written some of the very best work on American foreign policy, on grand strategy. He's also written enormously on international history. Indeed, John, in some sense, would be part of my role model in a way. He's one of these great people who can both unite a keen empirical study of history, real history, but integrated into a larger theoretical conceptual framework. And did, I think, with enormous skill in his great book, I think his really great book, if everybody's ever defined by a great work, it certainly is John's, After Victory, Institutions, Strategic Restraint, and the Rebuilding of Order After Major Wars. If anybody doesn't think it's possible to write both great international history and combine it with international relations, well, I'd say go and buy that book and you'll see how it can be done by John Eikenberry. John began his career at Princeton 20 years ago. John then moved to the State Department. He then moved to the Carnegie. He was for a number of years at Georgetown and has now returned as the Albert G. Milbank Professor of Politics and International Affairs at Princeton University. I've known John myself personally for 10 years. We collaborated a few years ago on a project on American democracy promotion. It began in Tokyo. It went on to some sort of conclusion in Washington, and we ended up, I think, with it finally being concluded in Wales. So there you go. It was quite a collaboration, and I think produced a great volume. But anyway, it's wonderful to welcome John here, not for the first time to the LSE, but certainly to speak for the Cold War Studies Center. We're honored to have him to speak on a subject very dear to my heart and certainly to his, From Containment to Preemption, American Grand Strategies Revisited. John, you're most welcome at the London School of Economics. John Eikenberry.
Thank you. Thank you, Nick. It's great to be here, and congratulations on the new center. It's great to be here for this inaugural festivity, and also to be here in your interesting series. And it's great to be part of the group that you've heard over the course of the semester. Thank you also for a very generous introduction. Can everyone hear me?
How's that mic working? Pull the mic straight in front of you.
I'll tell you what.
We can put on great lectures. We can't put on great electricity.
We'll turn that one off. And can you hear me from this one? Okay.
Yeah.
There we are. Well, thanks so much. And it's great to be here. And I look forward to your comments. I am going to talk about American grand strategy over the post-war era and try to make sense of the transition from the Cold War to the current era and talk about what the old era looked like, the strands, particularly in American grand strategy, and the new demands and environmental changes that are creating opportunities for new ideas and new problems and now new rethinking even now through the current, if you will, three-year cycle of post-9/11 foreign policy, what we've learned, what works, what doesn't work. I do think that as someone who's written about big moments in world history, great transformations, kind of earthquakes, if you will, big bangs in world history, we're at a moment that feels like one, not in the same clear-cut way as a post-war moment, but a sense that we're at a moment where big ideas are on the table, where countries of all different sorts are putting basic questions about the nature of the international system on the table. So in that sense, it's like the 1940s. Henry Kissinger argued recently that he has never seen a moment when the world was, in his words, in such a state of flux with so few agreed upon rules and institutions to guide the flow of change. And indeed, big shifts are afoot and are changing the strategic environment in which the United States, as this powerful country, thinks about its grand strategies and rethinks its Cold War tradition. I would say there are at least five big shifts that are making this a kind of 1940s moment. One, of course, is this long-term shift, if you will, the decline of old threats, particularly in Europe, particularly the marked by the end of the Cold War. It was 11-9, not 9-11, which was the great moment in Europe, and it changed the Atlantic relationship, and it has implications more broadly, implications about the future of alliances. Some people say NATO is gone already. Eastern European countries are joining a party that is really over with. But more generally, intellectual policy questions about the future of alliances in an era where you don't have that kind of threat. A second new circumstance is the rise of new threats. Obviously, this is what has consumed Washington, dramatically revealed in 9/11. Non-state gangs, ideologically motivated, religiously perhaps, threatened to acquire massive violence capability that previously only states could acquire. This is new. This is disturbing. Some people call this the privatization of war, that what previously you could identify in the international system as violence capability under the control of sovereign states, now you don't know who they are, you don't know what they have. And we don't know what to do about it. This is a genuine intellectual problem. And it plays havoc with old notions of deterrence, alliance, self-defense, Article 51 of the United Nations. And it creates a remarkable ambiguity at the core of the assessment, which is, I think it should be at least, threat assessment. What is the nature of this threat? We don't know. And if you have been following the discussion of threats in the last few years, you have witnessed perhaps the most sloppy and inexact discussion across the global elite of security specialists of threat and threat perception that we've seen in recent history. It doesn't compare with the Cold War exercise of threat assessment that was described by some as bean counting. This is so much more art than science, and it creates the kind of opportunity for a hyperbole where you have some people like Norman Podhoretz, the godfather, if you will, of neoconism, who argues that we are in the midst of World War IV, and you have Democrats, liberal Democrats in Washington, for example, delegates to the Democratic Party convention last August, only 6% of those polled Democrats thought foreign policy was an important issue. So we have this incredible, and that's just in the United States, these incredible different views. Coming back to the second great shift in the in strategic environment, the rise of new threats. The third shift is the main unit itself, the unipolar state, the rise of American power. No state has been so powerful in history. We're going to talk more about this later. 5% of the world's population, soon it will have 50% of the world's expenditure on defense. 80% of military R&D. For the first time in the modern era, the world's leading state can operate on a global stage without a counterbalancing state coalition. We call that unipolarity. And the entire world is trying to figure out what it all means. What are the new rules to this unipolar moment? How will the United States act? Will it be benign and act in the way that it did during the Cold War, or will it operate in new ways? The old ways coded by many as a kind of liberal hegemonic actor, providing public goods, operating within loose rules, and building partnerships and alliances. And the U.S., too, is trying to figure out how to deal with this power. And you've got an incredible array of debates going on. Using that power because it won't last forever to engage in transformations that won't be possible in 10 years. Use it while before you lose it. Others arguing that it is a more permanent condition and needs to be caged and made benign and legitimate so that it can be spent like a money in the bank over over a generation or two. And others, of course, are disputing the very premise. Unipolarity, well, not in economics, certainly not in global social terms. So what precisely does this distinctive power formation mean? A fourth shift, the rise of new power centers, India and China. Kishore Mahbubani, who has a new book just out in several public speeches recently that I've heard, says there are 6 billion eyeballs looking at America. My rough calculation means that's 3 billion people looking, I think that's India and China, looking at the United States saying it's our turn. Timothy Garton-Ash, in his new book, Free World, says that the West has, Europe and America, about roughly 20 years to keep their hands on the rules and institutions of the global system. After that, there will be Asian hands on that system, and that's the reason, in his view, for Europe and America to collaborate now, because there are the stakes are higher than we often acknowledge. History tells us that these rising moments are can be conflictual. The Thucydides kind of argument about power transitions creating conflict, even war. So that is something that, again, is creating, if you will, kind of anticipations of new problems, which unravel and create tensions today about how to deal with China in particular. And finally, the rise of religious Islamic extremism. This is creating all sorts of new questions that those of us who study international relations haven't had to deal with for the Cold War era, because it was a very, it was ideological, but it was in a profound sense a secular kind of global struggle. Now we have something that looks very different. Some people call it civilizational clash, but it seems to me the more profound question is the question about the future of modernity, the question of what are the pathways to modernization. The expectation, I think, that was built in the West during the Cold War was that this is a formation that has legs, that has history on its side. At least it felt that way by the 1970s, that there was a pathway to modernization. So the Soviet Union's failure was confirmation of this, and it was a modernization path that was universal. It was based on values that are universal. And the future of America's project, which was there in the background of the Cold War, was what was confirmed as well by the course of the Cold War. And so there was a kind of mutuality between the American project and the global flow of history, where what the American project seemed to go with what other countries wanted to, where they wanted to be taken. And from a scholarly perspective, our theories of international relations were built on that anticipation. Theories that were premised on kind of a notion of rationality, secularism, constitutionalism, liberalism, integrative, interdependent anticipations, and universal values and interests pushing all of this forward. We may have to start rethinking that as the secular future and its universal appeal. So it's not surprising that we are then, if these are some of the most obvious salient shifts in the environment, thinking that we are at a 1940s-style great moment. And we certainly are, judged by the debate. At Princeton, we're having a great book series, reading books that are great books from 60 years ago. It celebrated an anniversary. Hayek's Road to Serfdom, Polanyi's The Great Transformation, E.H. Carr is coming up, other books that Popper's book are all emblematic of great ideas written mostly by Europeans who witnessed the savagery of the 1930s and World War II, trying to make sense of what this new world might look like. The kind of moment of great ideas, I think, is back, at least in circles talking about grand strategy, and at least in the United States talking about alternative pathways forward. And even the Bush administration, if you're watching it, has this famous struggle between what Brent Scowcroft has called the traditionalists, such as Colin Powell, who's on the way out, cautious, status quo-oriented, managing U.S. preeminence, taking care of the American system, if you will, and transformists, as he calls them, neocons, pushing for a final solution, excuse that phrase, for old, enduring problems, regime change being the main action that will make these solutions go away for good, asserting U.S. primacy and arguing in the background that American order, that world order is basically can only be secured by the presence, the visible presence of American power. And indeed, the debate has since widened after 9/11, and even more so since the debacle in Iraq, the lingering crisis between the United States and Europe, and what is scary to many of us, the anti-Americanism around the world in all of its different guises. So we're at a 1940s moment, and I want to make three arguments to try to make sense of where we're going, what seems to be ratified by history as possibilities, and others that aren't. The three arguments, the first a very historical set of arguments that I'm going to spend 15 minutes or so on, talking about the world order that was built in the 1940s through the years of the Cold War. I argue it was built through two grand strategies, out of Washington, out of America, a liberal grand strategy, liberal internationalist inspiration, and of course realist balance of power strategy. These strategies worked well together. Many of the actual diplomatic statesmen, architects of order personified both of them. I think Truman did. They were anchored in both political parties, and they defined the mainstream. My second argument is the Bush Revolution has brought forward two other strategic traditions which were pushed aside during the Cold War. A neoconservative view, this is a transformative ideology, really. The U.S. should use its hard power to transform regions and overturn threats. The key conviction is that the U.S. power itself, and perhaps alone it alone, is the best source of global order and stability. It has intellectual kinship with ideas in the 1940s and 50s and 60s on rollback, on using American power to overturn and transform, in that case, Soviet communism. A second set of ideas that were pushed aside during the Cold War, conservative nationalist ideas that are often conflated with neoconservative ideas. This is a different tradition, perhaps older, really, in American history. It's what Walter Russell Mead has called Jacksonians. It's what Anatole Levin has called, probably here on this stage, pugnacious nationalism. Some of it is high-minded conservatism. Those who have thought to who seek to protect American sovereignty and republican virtues from getting involved in international politics. Because we know getting involved means power politics, and power politics as a feedback loop on the nature of the domestic polity. It makes it harder for a weak state, which was built into the Constitution, a value prized in the American tradition, it makes it harder for that to survive. It brings up questions of strong state prerogatives, eroding liberties of various sorts, and this is a genuine intellectual position coming from the right, and in a different guise from the left. But there are others who are more straightforward, emotionally nationalist, who are basically reactionary, saying to hell with the world. They often use different words than that. Phrases that are actually seen on bumper stickers on typically pickup trucks. You know, I love Jesus, my gun, and NASCAR racing. There's a kind of emotional, it's a red state view. I know it. I grew up in a red state. And it's real. It's there. But we can talk about it. It's there, but it's not a majority. It is a vocal minority. And I'm not even sure it's growing. But it certainly has more voice. And part of it is that some of the other constraints that have made it for many decades a secondary phenomenon have peeled away, thereby letting this set of ideas come forward. My point really here about these alternative ideologies is really threefold. Number one, these nationalist and neoconservative visions are ultimately, in my view, contradictory, different, and mutually unsustainable, even though they are both present in the Bush administration. My other point here is that they've both existed in the shadows of the Cold War, but they are here now on they are now here in harder form on the front stage. And thirdly, the kind of theme I want to kind of put forward, and this is the kernel of my most important idea, I hope, this evening, is this, that the Cold War created an international order where the United States, in effect, was, through its own efforts and by the solicitations of Asians and Europeans who were America's partners during the Cold War, in effect contracted out for world order and global governance to America. We had a kind of privatized global government system, which was manifest in the institutions of the Cold War, most importantly NATO, but also the other institutions which I'm going to talk about, the liberal-inspired institutions, the multilateral economic and political institutions. So the U.S., in effect, provided the kind of structures through this American system, this Cold War-generated system, for running world order, for managing global affairs. And the U.S. did it in a way without really knowing it was doing it. It only really became clear that it was doing it when the Cold War ended. There were reasons why it wanted to continue to do it after the Cold War and why others wanted it, because it did entail providing public goods, and it was done in a way that made other countries complicitous in the system, strategic partners in various ways. The United States was more or less rule-based, benign, non-imperial. But two things have changed. Number one, some of the American face it's showing the world doesn't look like that privatized global governance system that we saw in the past. And number two, Americans who were living in that order, many of them, these pugnacious nationalists, didn't know they were in a government providing this global order. They don't know that they are through, that their foreign policy is not simply a national foreign policy like everybody else, but is partly woven into the sinews of a global system. This is, in effect, global governance based on American internationalism on stilts, on a very weak foundation, where Americans, certainly in red states, don't know that they are part of this fabric of international order. And so that's part of the vulnerability of it. Let me start with the historical argument, but end with the argument about the problems, the contradictions, really, in the Bush grand strategy. And I want to argue at the end that we need to re-envisage order along liberal lines that will still allow for that American unipolar position to be part of the solution rather than the problem of global governance. Historical arguments first. Over the last 60 years, I think world order was built on these two grand strategies, a realist strategy that's familiar to you. It is what the work of the center, the Cold War Center, really has as its main focus, the politics, policies, tensions, and outcomes, really, of the Cold War, driven by, really, a realist strategy out of America based on balance of power thinking, bipolarity, deterrence, ideological struggle with the Soviet Union. It yielded a bounty of institutions and partnerships, NATO, the U.S.-Japan alliance, U.S.-Korean alliance, and a wider array of security relationships around the world. This American security order has survived the end of the Cold War, and as Chalmers Johnson reminds us, it's actually expanded in many ways. NATO has expanded eastward, the U.S.-Japan alliance has been reconfirmed, and in many ways, new bases around the world have been set up. Chalmers Johnson, in his book, says there are over 50 countries where the United States has bases. And in his book, you find that there are 123 American military golf courses around the world. So there's a whole system there that is somewhat invisible, but there is an American military system in place. The product of the Cold War still in existence in parts of the world, more provocative, but other parts it's been extended and invited. The other grand strategy is what I call liberal grand strategy. People didn't know this existed, and I've tried to make this point in some of my writing, that there was this non-realist strategy that was also doing a lot of work during the Cold War, before it, in the shadows, and after it, built on promoting economic openness, rule of law, joint management of global problems, multilateral rules and institutions, democracy promotion, and cooperative security. There is a security component to the liberal strategy, which I'll talk about in a moment. But it was embraced by both political parties during the Cold War and after. As Mick said, I was at the State Department the last year of the Bush administration, which was right when the Cold War ended, in August of 1991, if I recall. I went into the State Department right when a certain president from the Soviet Union, Gorbachev, went on holiday. There was a coup in Moscow. A young charismatic politician got up on a tank in Moscow, Boris Yeltsin, and put his fist in the air and rallied the democratic forces, all of this on CNN. The coup was put down, but the Federation collapsed, and the Cold War was over, and I found myself at the State Department on that day. And it was interesting to find diplomats who for 50 years had been pursuing containment now trying to figure out what to do post-containment. And what they found was liberal grand strategy. My goodness, it was already there. So Baker and Bush gave speeches, most of them written by Robert Zoellick, on promoting the Euro-Atlantic community, relying on values. That's what brings America and Europe together. We don't have the Cold War threat, the external threat, which realists tell us is necessary for cohesion, but we do have a glue. But I must say, at the State Department, one of my colleagues was pulling his hair out saying, what's the glue that's going to hold this system together? Well, it was really this liberal glue. Clinton had liberal ideas, of course, in a more grandiose form than Bush 1, engagement, enlargement. Bush 2 may not want to admit it, but there are liberal grand strategy ideas in his portfolio, the Doha trade round, China policy in part, hemispheric trade vision. These liberal ideas date back to the 40s and are deeply rooted in the American political experience. And they are a strategy in many ways. And I wrote this, I remember, in an op-ed piece in the Los Angeles Times in the late 1990s. I said, you know, the Cold War is over, but we aren't lost at sea without a compass. There is more intellectual guidance there than simply containment Cold War pursuit. There is liberal grand strategy, enlargement, institution building, open trade, democracy promotion, creating communities and networks that operate without a threat. And I wrote this in the Sunday Los Angeles Times, went out to a million readers, got one letter from the White House, National Security Advisor, dear Professor Eikenberry, thank you. We didn't know we had a strategy. We thought we were just a mouse in a you know, maze sniffing out the cheese. Your op-ed told us we are strategic, and thank you. We'll put it on the bulletin board. They were so grateful for many weeks after that that they now could feel more Kissingerian in their liberal instincts, that there was something deep and strategic about these impulses towards openness and trade and so forth. So that's my first historical argument. You had these double strategies at work during the 40s. Secondly, these strategies yielded a remarkable political order. And the heart of my work over the last few years has been to try to expose the logic and contours of this liberal order. I teach a course called Logic of the West. I think about what is the character of it, and it has a lot more than simply containment. It was more than simply the artifact of the Cold War. It's like nothing that the world has seen before. It's certainly based on a precondition of capitalism and democracy, but it's an engineered political order with bargains along the way. And there are two bargains, I think, that have been the heart of this order that has been anchored in the Atlantic but goes out into Japan, and it's an expansive order. One is a realist bargain based on Cold War imperatives, that the U.S. would provide security, protection for Europe and East Asia and other partners, and also access to its markets, technologies, and supplies in the context of an open world economy. And in return, these countries in Europe and Asia would be stable partners who would provide diplomatic, economic, and logistical support for the U.S. as it led this larger order during the Cold War, this larger anti-communist foreign policy, but after the Cold War, this larger order. So there's a bargain there: security, protection, open markets, integration, for providing stable partnership and diplomatic and logistical support. The other bargain from the 40s onward was a less explicit one. It was a liberal bargain, which was addressing not external threats but the uncertainties and vagaries of American power, that Asian and European partners would agree to accept U.S. leadership rather than resist it in exchange for the U.S. willingness to restrain and commit its power, to make its power more predictable, institutionalized, to cage American power. The U.S. would agree to play by the rules. It would operate within a mutually agreeable set of institutions. It would be benign. It would be open. It would be hegemonic, but a different type of hegemonic power. And in return, Japan and Europe would bandwagon rather than balance. If Bill Gates were here, he'd say, oh, I know what you mean. U.S. would make itself user-friendly. U.S. power would be made safe for the world, and other states would join this U.S.-led order. These bargains are clearly unraveling, and that may be part of the problem. that there's kind of misperception about what is the bargain today. Some in America still think we are providing security for Europe, therefore we should get a check in that credit. We are providing a public good. If the other side doesn't check that public good provision, then it doesn't exist politically. So there's a debate about that we want to talk about. But I don't want to talk about that now. I want to talk about a third historical argument, and that is that this post-war system, Western system, has been remarkably durable and legitimate. And this is because there was much more going on during the Cold War than simply fighting communism. There was the creation of two orders, the creation of a containment order. This is the one that we talk about. Truman, Acheson, Kennan, who's now 100 years old this year, residing in Princeton. Morgenthau, by the way, is 100 years old this year. His birth was 100 years ago. These heroic diplomats trying to figure out the nature of Soviet power and constructing a response to it were creating the containment order. But there was a second order that some of those were also involved in, but others were involved in creating a post-war order in the West. And their challenge was not to find responses to the Soviet communism in the East, but responses to the 1930s. Because it was the 1930s that most scared 1940s era diplomats. Truman had a very economic theory of history in his intellectual portfolio. It was the economic blocks, 1933, Ottawa. It was going off the gold standard. It was the regional projects in Europe, the Reichmark, the Japanese East Asian co-prosperity sphere. It was the British pound sterling area. And, of course, the Soviet Union with its regional project. And everybody in 1940 and 41 and 42 in Washington who was an IR type like me was asking the question, can America be a great power and exist in a world of blocks? Can it be a hemispheric power? And the answer was, by 1942, Spickman's book of 1942 really answered the question. The answer was no, that it has to have this kind of larger access to the Eurasian rimland. So there were lots of ideas going into this order that we are finding ourselves leaving behind, not just strategic containment ideas, but ideas about economic openness, that capitalism should be international rather than national, regional, or imperial. It should be a managed order, New Deal ideas about institutions, permanent international regulatory agencies doing things. That was very new. That was a breakthrough. That was embedded in Bretton Woods. It was foreshadowed in the Atlantic Charter of 1941. It was implicit in the Marshall Plan and even in the NATO 1949 NATO Pact, which, as one American diplomat said, was a pact that, following more the Marshall Plan logic than a new Cold War logic, it had a lot to do with reconstructing Europe and not simply a counter alliance in face of Soviet threat. NATO was, as one American diplomat said, an attempt to get Europe on its feet and off our backs. So there was this whole project. There was a social bargain embedded in this. We call it the welfare state. An open system would be full of fluctuations. And so maybe economists can tell us that winners win more than losers lose in this open system, but there are losers. So if you divide some of the gains to the losers, you have a more stable, secure, socially provisioned order. And finally, and this is the key point for looking back, this is the key historical point of the last 50 years, in my view, there was also a fourth idea, and this was security co-binding. Now, I know that's a term that makes your heart start to pitter-patter. Security co-binding, what is that? It sounds interesting. For me, it's my term for the liberal security practice to be differentiated from the realist security practice of balancing. And it really means tying potentially rival states together. And it was embedded in the Franco-German solution, if you will, after World War II. That was the most important expression of it. It was also embedded in Lord Ismay's unusually candid remarks about what NATO was. It was an alliance to keep the Russians out, the Germans down, and the Americans in. That's a co-binding logic, a kind of glimmer of that logic. Binding security ties is the most important innovation of world politics in the 20th century. France chose to link itself to Germany after 1945 rather than balance against it. It was pioneering the logic. You can find glimmerings of it in 1815, but this was really a new strategy. It's strategy of loving your potential enemy to death. The U.S. got something out of this by binding itself to Europe as well. It got to become overnight a European power, likewise in Asia. But the bargain was it would open itself up to consultations, partnership from others. It created a political process that made Europe able to be part of the process of decision-making. Not that Washington would be doing everything Europe said, but that there would be a political process, not simply interstate interaction, but an institutionalized political process. That, too, was new. And that's something that's not bad to have, because it creates a kind of ongoing dialogue that creates control and reassurance. Pacto di contrahendo, pacts of restraint. That's what we have here. Albert Hirschman called it voice opportunity. You get voice, you get less exit. So there was something profound going on here. Security co-binding. If you think about it, there are three security practices available for states. One is hiding, that's isolationism. The second one is balancing, that's the one we celebrated. That's the one we've seen most prevalent across 500 years of history. And finally, binding. So hiding, balancing, and binding. We've seen a lot more binding in the second half of the 20th century than we've ever seen before, and it's changed the system profoundly. Hiding is no longer an option in the nuclear era, so that we have a shifting set of incentives and practices on the table. Germany, after unification, discovered the logic of binding when Helmut Kohl realized that unification of Germany would create a state inside of Europe that would be now bigger than France or the other states, that had a kind of symmetry of equal power that allowed for European integration to proceed. Now Germany would look bigger. Helmut Kohl engaged in the binding gambit, saying, if you allow Germany to unify, we will redouble our commitment to European monetary integration and single currency. So Germany will be united, but it more intensively bound to its neighbors. And that was an explicit part of the bargain, not simply due to the worries and vibrations from Gorbachev, who thought that a unified Germany inside of NATO would lead to what he said, in my seat next week there will be a general sitting here, but also Thatcher and Mitterrand explicitly only grudgingly accepted German unification with this notion that it would be Germany, more intensely a European Germany. And by the way, one of the most interesting presentations of that argument is a book written by Condoleezza Rice. So now let me, with that as kind of prologue, let me just, my last minutes, talk about the Bush grand strategy and how that wonderful history that I've told, the creation of the most successful international order in history, and I mean that, if you defined in terms of wealth creation and physical security, we have this order that was created over that period that has been more durable, successful in all those different ways than any other order in history. And strangely enough, it doesn't even have a name. It's an order that is not a region. It's not just the Atlantic. We don't even have a name for it, but it exists. Greater Industria, Pax Democratica, I don't know, there are different terms you might have, but it is transcontinental, it's got lots of different facets, and I would say even with all the pushing and hollering from the Bush administration, it's going to have the last word, but I want to talk about the Bush Revolution before we come to that. Two new realities are shaking the system up, big time. One is, and I've mentioned both of them in my introduction, the rise of new catastrophic threats, terrorism. Small networks of angry, determined people can acquire and use massive violence capability previously only possible with some states. Here we have officials asking, are these threats so dangerous and so new and so novel, the privatization of war, that all the old rules, alliances, deterrence, sovereignty, Article 51, have to be rethought? Key Bush people in the revolution say yes. And even realists, so-called realists like Condoleezza Rice, has, at least for a phase, we're going to see in the next period whether she still has these new stripes. But her new stripes are, we have to let go of all that stuff. We got to let go of that Cold War thinking. We are in a new brave era, and we have to think newly about the threats. That's creating incentives for new ideas, new thinking. And in with that, those new threats manifest by 9/11 are doing another thing that's making this new threat in the environment create new ideas and new grand strategies. It's making the United States more risk-prone. It's made America a revisionist rather than a status quo power. Because the worst-case scenarios, as Rumsfeld puts it most darkly and most eloquently, we don't know what we don't know. I was at the meeting where he rolled this out for the first time, and I put it in one of my articles. He came into a trilateral commission meeting. Colin Powell was the first to speak, and he was so reassuring. You know, there's the Africa portfolio, you know, Europe and Russia, and kind of very gentle diplomat in the best sense of that. And he started talking about, before he gave his speech about the way the world was, this is a couple years ago, he said, you know, I'm still working with my inner city children's program. So you had this kind of feeling of, oh, that's the face of America right there. And then Rumsfeld got up, and he had a scowl on his face, and said, I'm going to talk about terrorism. And he said, there are things we know about terrorism. And everybody said, yeah, oh, yeah. Things we know, okay. Then he said, there are things we know we don't know. And then everybody starts saying, interesting, yeah. And then he said, and then there are things we don't know. And everybody was like, whoa, let me write that down. What does that mean? You know? And what it means, there may be groups we've never heard of who have the capacity we didn't think they did to acquire, in the most important sense, nuclear weapons, and could use that violence at a moment's notice in ways that are totally, as your prime minister has said, without any sense that there are moral or ethical restraints on the use of that violence. So this creates big ideas. Let's rethink. So we invade two Arab Muslim states in 18 months. There is a risk-prone aspect to these new threats that have to be understood, combined with the new ideas. And the second new factor is, of course, U.S. unipolar power. It looks like the United States can do it, or it did for this period leading up to Iraq. But American unipolar power is more than simply the United States has 50% of world military expenditure. There's a deeper transformation in the international system that heightens this power, certainly as it is felt around the world. And this is what I call the Westphalian flip. It sounds like an Olympic discipline, a diving discipline, but I mean it in the sense that the Westphalian system has flipped on its head. And let me make this argument. You can disagree with it. There are complexities that I paced over. But for 500 years, really, international order, in one way or another, was held together by the Westphalian logic, which had two components. At the international level, a diffusion and distribution, and in some rough sense, an equilibrium of power among major states. Diffusion, distribution, and equilibrium of power among major states, great powers. And domestically, you had, starting with 1648 and increasingly the rise of sovereign state capacity and the extinguishing or the relative decline of other rival organizing forms, and manifest in sovereign statehood defined in Weberian terms as the legitimate, the monopoly on the legitimate use of violence within that territory, supreme legal authority. So we have the Westphalian logic, always, as Krasner will tell us, always abridged, always violated hypocritically in all these different ways, but still the basic logic, distribution, equilibrium internationally, hard states at home. Well, that system in interesting ways has flipped on its head. Now we have the U.S. with a quasi-monopoly on the use of violence internationally, and we have eroded state sovereignty at home around the world. The second feature, of course, has been going on for a long time. Eleanor Roosevelt, the Universal Declaration on Human Rights, the United Nations, the human rights revolution, making individuals, specifying rights for individuals that are not simply secured by their own sovereign state, but by the international community in some perhaps unenforceable way, but nonetheless important way. And then post 9/11, a whole nother layer of the sovereignty onion has been peeling away, because now even, you know, hostile states, autocratic states that have the possibility of weapons of mass destruction are targeted for extinction. Sovereignty means nothing, even if you aren't actively using force across your borders. So this is a sovereignty revolution, coupled with a American military monopoly, quasi-monopoly, which turns the logic on its head. And it would be surprising if the world weren't vibrating. Think of it, and this is my way of bringing this point home, think of this as a small town that for 500 years had multiple neighborhoods with different police districts, each autonomous, keeping the peace in different districts, different parts over the tracks in different ways. Overnight, or at least in a generation, turning into a town where you have one sheriff and no locks on the doors. And that sheriff says, I'm going to keep the peace, trust me, I can go anywhere I want, anytime I want, and I can arrest somebody, actually I can use deadly force on somebody, even if they haven't actively attacked me or anybody else, if they've got a bad look on their face, if they've got a record for being a bad guy in the neighborhood, I can take them out now. I can walk through doors, locks mean nothing, and I'm not subject to a review board, no one voted me into office, no accountability mechanism in place. I am the sheriff. The Bush administration has passionately embraced this new post-Westphalian logic of international order, unipolar security. The national security strategy, when it says no peer competitor, it is saying unipolarity forever. The U.S. will provide the security order. No rivals. Forget it. It's a hegemonic strategy with the U.S. remaining a class by itself. The U.S. will provide order, but in return it will want to be treated differently. Exceptions, buyouts, if you will, to universal standards. No landmines treaty, because we have unusual obligations, ladies and gentlemen. Our troops are on the DMZ with Korea. ICC, no way. We have troops that are put in harm's way in the way none of you do, speaking to the global community. So we are unusually open to politically activated lawsuits. So the U.S., in the Bush vision, will stand above the international system, providing security. It sees this doing a favor for everybody. That's important to note. And I think of it as Muhammad Ali, you know, when he, the heavyweight fighter from the 60s, said, you know, I float like a butterfly and sting like a bee. You know, that is America, kind of hovering above the international system, not really being in it, but always being there, able to use force. And this was brought out in Bush's West Point speech when he said, America has an intendance to keep military strength beyond challenge, thereby making destabilizing arms races pointless, limiting rivalry to trade and other lesser pursuits. This is the most Wilsonian statement by an American president since Woodrow Wilson, when Wilson said the U.S. power would be used to, quote, create a dominion of right, unquote. The cutting edge of this, of course, is preemption, the use of force. And it is, if you think about it, basically America doing what during the Westphalian 500 years no one would or could do, which is stand up and say, we will be the world's Leviathan. We will solve the problem of Hobbes by providing centralized power and not power diffused and in an equilibrium. So the world is shaking. What does this mean? What kind of sheriff will this be? And this is a colloquial question that you may not get it in this crowd, but will America be a sheriff that is represented by Mayberry RFD? That's this television show from the 60s. Again, a happy, kind of slightly absent-minded, but very benign and congenial kind of sheriff in a small town, kind of walking the beat, you know, always got a joke, always, you know, helping somebody in distress, but nothing really important really is happening. Is that the American Leviathan, or is it the LAPD? You know, is this a kind of out of control use of force, not disciplined, no standards? You know, it's the president and what he thinks, working out his problems with his father. I mean, is this some kind of less regulated sheriff? And so there are questions on the table. There's no reason to be surprised by the level of big rethinking going on based on this Westphalian flip. But this is where I want to end my lecture. There's a second Bush move that's not simply the post-Westphalian move, standing up as the Leviathan, but there's a shift which is this move in the other direction that I mentioned that had been during the Cold War on the sidelines, and that is conservative nationalism. This is a different view. They don't even know what Westphalia means. This is a view that has been around in American thinking, the American experience, for a long time, really as long as America has been around. But this is the conservative nationalism, which says no to the outside world, which does not want to be involved in international pursuits that it can't control. Jacksonianism, pugnacious nationalism. But what's interesting is that while these ideas have been around in America in the 20th century, at each of the other three great moments of transition where America unusually had power to shape the resulting international order, 1919, 1945, and 1941, at each of those moments, America stepped forward with a liberal discourse about order. What is a liberal discourse about order? Well, I've talked about it in my historical remarks today, but really, there are three components to the liberal discourse. One is the exercise of U.S. power is consistent with the strengthening of the fabric of the international system. That is to say, the American project means building up partnerships and institutions. The building of an international community and the advancement of American interests are not mutually inconsistent. Secondly, institutions are a tool of American power, not a constraint. And thirdly, international legitimacy matters. There are international tests that we need to pay attention to. That liberal discourse, in one way or another, informed Wilson, informed Truman and FDR, and even Bush 1 and Clinton. But those ideas are not prevalent today, but rather a conservative discourse on order, which also has three components. Number one, there really isn't an international community. It's a kind of polite fiction, but, you know, when these nationalists use that term, if they do, they kind of roll their eyes. Condoleezza Rice, in her famous foreign affairs article, said that in so many words. Secondly, institutions are a constraint on American power. That's Kagan's thesis and Krauthammer. And thirdly, legitimacy begins and ends at home. Krauthammer says, we don't need the French to buy into our policy to establish American rectitude. Why does French agreement to what we do establish something called legitimacy? Why doesn't that just establish that the French like what we're doing? And why does the fact that they don't like what we're doing mean that what we're doing is illegitimate if what we did came out of a legitimate domestic constitutional system? That's not a stupid argument. That's part of the conservative discourse, and that's in the arguments made by a certain John Bolton, who is head of arms control at the State Department today. So those ideas are in play today. My argument is that those are old ideas, but whether it's accidental history or not, they weren't in play in decisive ways in those earlier moments, but they are today. They were represented by Robert Taft of Ohio in the 1940s, a conservative Republican nationalist, a pugnacious nationalist, who voted against the United Nations, voted against NATO and the UN Charter. But it's simply in play in new ways that those ideas were not in play before. I'll simply end by saying that those two Bush shifts are inconsistent, contradictory, and together do two things. They create the two outcomes. They undersupply cooperation and they oversupply resistance. The United States cannot build an international order around stepping forward as a conservative Leviathan. You can't try to rule the world without obeying the rules. You can't act in the name of the international community if you don't believe there's an international community. And you can't act to promote universal values while stressing American exceptionalism. Those are three deep contradictions in the current amalgam of ideas, which, as I said, are not a single set of ideas, but two ideas that have, as I said before, been around before, lurking in the shadows, kind of funky ideas in Washington cocktail circles, but you could always go back and get another drink and say, boy, I'm glad that guy's not in office. But now those ideas are there, and it's quite remarkable. It says something about unipolarity and what disciplines power when, as realists would be chagrined to find out, including John Mearsheimer, so I'll end on referring back to my compatriot who probably was equally concerned about the current situation but comes from a very different intellectual tradition, you can't run a system like that. It's going to create the kind of divisions we see today. And so my own, to anticipate what would be the next lecture if I came back next year, would be that we need to rethink all those great strategies, that none of them really provides the answer to those new threats or new shifts in the strategic environment today. Realism, balance of power, realism can't do it. It can't make sense of unipolarity. And it can't make sense of what really is, if realism sees the world as ultimately perfected through the establishment of nation states, it can't make sense of a world where some parts of the region will never have nation states. Liberals can't understand American power, and unipolarity is difficult for liberals to understand because they would like to offload responsibilities to the United Nations. So we're all in a kind of major rethink mode. And if I've done anything tonight, I would hope that I've at least created a kind of context for some of the discussion. And I look forward to your questions. And thank you very much for being so patient.
Some of you would want to be leaving. For those who are about to leave, or if you could do so fairly quickly, and then we can get to the Q&A. Thank you very much. We've got about 15 or 20 minutes for questions and answers. Where are the mic people? Are there mic people upstairs in the gallery? Yeah, hi. Great. If you could just quickly leave, and then we can get on with the Q&A. Thank you very much. Okay. Right. I'll take the first question from the floor. Do I see a hand waving? I got two. I'll take the gentleman here, who I know is Chris Alden, and I'll take the gentleman there, whom I don't know. But anyway, yeah, please, Chris. Chris Alden from the Department of International. Chris.
Quick. Thank you very much. I was curious how you would apply the conservative nationalism argument to the attitude or changing attitude on economic policy. For example, free trade areas, the simultaneous promotion of WTO, but ambivalence, increasing ambivalence towards it, and the push towards establishing what could be read as alternative economic arrangements.
Okay, we'll take that one straight away, John, on WTO and economics. Yeah,
it's interesting that the anti-free trade voices in America have been historically divided in the kind of the right wing and the left wing of the two parties. So, and you had Naderites who were anti-free trade and left-centered critics, and then you had people like Pat Buchanan, and right-wing critics. But they never sort of had critical mass because they were kind of extreme minorities in both their party, so they didn't really have the kind of voice, and you also had the kind of with Clinton, you had a kind of unusual liberal who was willing to make some hard choices for free trade. He went ahead with NAFTA and started the Doha round. The conservatives, you know, are kind of, they're split on trade, free trade. If I were to say which of the two parties has the free trade ideology more firmly embedded in it, I would say the Republican Party does. But it's the Democrats who are, if we value free trade, you have in some sense more to worry about post Clinton, when the next president may not be, and Kerry was not as willing to develop a kind of language that would let him kind of appeal to both the trade union types and the protectionists and the free traders. I guess I would say uh, the
there, I don't see conservative nationalism having quite as big an impact on economics. Where you're going to get it is most is in kind of you'll continue to have the kind of criticism of NAFTA and integration in the Americas, but on balance you're going to have you're going to have free trade agreements continuing in on offer. Zelik, who is the American trade representative, is pushing for these kind of bilateral and regional trade agreements. He thinks ultimately they are consistent with global free trade. So I think you're going to see a lot of that movement. It's not going to be coded as protectionism, but it's going to be kind of more complex trade agreements that I don't think endanger the system, but are at the same time are not, you know, sort of highly nationalist, protectionist kinds of initiatives. So I'm not as worried in that regard on the economic side.
Yeah, wait until the dollar declines another 30%, John, then come back to Europe and say that. I'd be interested to hear that one. There's a gentleman here, please. You can pass the... thank you very much.
How far would you say that President Bush's preemptive strategy of West Point speech that you mentioned is shared by the American political and military establishment in general, on the one hand, and the democratic elites on the other?
Thank you very much. John, do you want to pick that one up?
Preemption, I think the most people in the administration have kind of walked back from it. I think that you certainly had key foreign policy establishment people who thought it was a bad idea to highlight it. Not to say it's not always an option. It always has been to act preemptively. But to make it, enshrine it as a rule, you know, a conservative like Kissinger said, it's a mistake to make it a rule that thereby creates a kind of principle that legitimates any country invading any other country based on no empirical evidence or no necessity of making a validation of that claim. So I think a lot of people, even sympathetic people who are in the administration or around it, would say, you know, in the end, looking back, it probably would have been better to say, not to try to create a kind of metaphysical superstructure for Iraq, but to say, okay, we know you aren't going to like this, but we've got to do this. You know, let us do this, and we'll come back and do everything else you like. You know, this is not the new America. This is kind of, we've got to get this out of this is something we care a lot about. Let us do it. Let's don't kind of throw the whole international system in an uproar. And that would have been, in hindsight, better than trying to create this whole new kind of brave new world of ideas about preemption. I think that's the conventional wisdom now.
Mm. There's a question in the middle here, please. I'll take that one quickly, and then there's some others, and I'll come back up. I'll come upstairs then. Yeah, please.
Armin H. Kenyon, lecturer at the Center for Civil Society. My question is, given these major shifts which you're discussing, where does this leave U.S. foreign policy efforts aimed at democracy promotion and civil society promotion? I've read Thomas Carruthers' new book, Critical Mission, and was wondering to get your perspectives on that as well.
You read Cox and Eikenberry and Inoguchi on American democracy promotion, by the way.
Really.
Anyway, John.
Well, I'm very, one thing that liberals and neoconservatives have in common is the view that if you can get democracy promotion, it is a good thing. If you can get democracy expansion, it's a good thing. That both believe that the domestic character of states matters a great deal, that democracy is not just has a kind of international implications that are good, but also it creates bases for development, the kind of rule of law and impact on domestic economic change within troubled states. So you aren't going to find anybody who's going to say we shouldn't be thinking about how to do it, shouldn't try to do it. But I think, everybody, the kind of argument that you can kind of topple regimes and there's kind of Democrats kind of waiting in the wings to take over is just, totally discredited. Even part of the neoconservative fold, people like Francis Fukuyama, who I'm running a study group with on grand strategy, got in trouble with his fellow neocons by writing a piece called The Neoconservative moment. My article on that topic was called The End of the Neoconservative Moment. His was a little bit more ambiguous, but moment says something, and he basically was saying that it's based on assumption about regime change and transformation that just is not embedded in reality. You know, it's all ideology. It doesn't match with the kind of power assets the United States has. You can use force, but you can't build countries up. There's a lot of interesting thinking going on that is kind of trying to go beyond that debate of, you know, democracy promotion through, you know, overturning autocratic states, the kind of longer term indirect kind of stuff that liberal internationalists have always thought is the more practical, longer term, and more irreversible kind of shifts. There's thinking going on, it kind of follows to some extent kind of the Neil Ferguson line that there really are parts of the world that will never become, even with the best efforts of everybody and the most resources that would never be realistically employed, we still aren't going to get nation states there. And once you kind of go over that cognitive threshold and say, oh, I said it, you know, and I remember the moment, most of us kind of have a kind of view of the world that every people should have a country and that democracy, legitimacy, respect for rights does entail territorial defined nation states that are roughly accord with this model, that we can't get beyond that. And if you get beyond that, you're an imperialist in some sense. And some of the people who try to get beyond it are liberal imperialists. But there are others who are saying, can we find ways to get the international community to some sense provide the capacities of states from the outside, a kind of more, you know, kind of contracting out for state capacity. Steve Krasner, an international relations colleague of mine at Stanford, is working on this, kind of how can you divide up and provide some aspects regionally of state capacity. And there's an interesting set of questions there. So there's a very rich, vibrant democracy promotion debate going on. And I think it should go on, and we should be every day thinking how to promote it. But we've kind of learned what doesn't work. And the other component to this is that a particular debate about democracy promotion in the Arab Muslim world, and there the debate framed in terms of Bernard Lewis's position, which really was an argument that had a huge impact on the administration, which didn't have anything to do with democracy promotion, but really it was an argument about how do you shake the Arab Muslim world up and get them on a kind of modernizing track. And his position was you've got to make a show of force. You've got to kind of almost humiliate and discredit certain parts of that world. Coming out of his, and then in the aftermath you find a secular democratic outcome. And in that sense, Bernard Lewis brings that experience from his pioneering work on Turkey. And the other side of the debate has never entered the Arab Muslim world via Turkey. They see a democratic future inside of Islam. And that debate is intensely in play at all levels of academia, in public intellectualism, and in the administration, foreign policy circles. And Bernard Lewis was meeting with, you know, Richard Cheney saying, get on with it. You've got to do it. Trying to buck up the administration to go ahead and invade. So that position was very much on display, and now we have the follow-on question about what can we do, if anything, to promote outcomes we would like to see in that part of the world, and it's loaded. It's totally loaded, as you know.
Thank you, John. There's a question down here. Patrick, yeah.
Patrick Holditch from the Foreign Office Research Department. You've already touched a little bit in answering one or two of the other questions, but I'll still go ahead with it. I was surprised you didn't really focus very much on Iraq and the impact that's had on the desirability of developing grand strategies. You've now touched a little bit on that. But I wonder if you could just speculate a bit more about what impact that is and will have on particularly the strength of conservative nationalism within the Bush administration, because it would seem in reshaping the the personnel of the administration, it's that brand which is at a stronger position now, yet they may be facing quite a serious challenge in justifying and indeed carrying out their policies over the next year or so.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, Iraq, and I just didn't have time to kind of get to that. This is going to be as important as 9/11, kind of sorting out Iraq. The debate on Iraq is going to go on for a generation, and there's going to be, you know, all sorts of positions. And how you come out on that, just like how you come out on the end of the Cold War, has huge impact on what you think you should do today. And I'm writing on that. I'm writing with Dan Dudney, writing a book on the end of the Cold War. Because how you settle that issue, and the neocons, of course, have taken their reading of the end of the Cold War and that's one of their 8 or 9 basic assumptions that have created their worldview. Mm-hmm. I think Iraq has undermined the neocon position in all sorts of ways. I don't think you're going to see, it's harder to be a neocon hawk in today's world post-Iraq for lots of different reasons. Intellectually, I mentioned the Frank Fukuyama and the kind of peeling off, you know, the harder to make the argument on intellectual terms. It's harder. It looks more ideological than it did. It doesn't look like it's mapping onto the world as much. Resources are not there. You can't do another Iraq. You've got 60% of the American military tied up in Iraq, either preparing to go there or coming back. So you can't do an Iran or a Syria or a North Korea, let alone the attending dangers that make them even more dangerous than Iraq was. So the neocon position, I think, is going to be just less forceful and less visible and part of the foreign policy. That's my view. I'm a rationalist. I think that's probably just a deduction. The nationalist position has really been strengthened in some ways. That's the kind of the hell with you. You know, that position is in the longer term the more robust position. The neocons, you know, really exist in the beltway. They're kind of smart, interesting people that you know, don't have real jobs. You know?
Just like academics.
There's not a neocon who drives a truck, for example. They drive BMWs and they drink great wine.
Yeah,
really great wine. There's a correlation there somehow.
They have houses in France too, don't they?
They do.
Yeah.
Yes. And you know, there's all sorts of other connections that are interesting to talk about. But I think that the conservative nationalist position is there. I think there one way you can mark this is the decline of my colleague and co-author and dear friend Charlie Kupchan makes a lot of this in his book. The end of the American era, the kind of end of the mainstream, particularly on the Republican side. You don't have as many Bob Doles and Richard Lugers and that kind of Republican conservative internationalists who were part of the 40s, who split off from Robert Taft and went with the anti-war project that grudgingly said, yes, we will be part of the GATT and UN and so forth. So where are those folks? And the kind of decline of Republic, you know, the kind of the separation of regionally of the two parties. You don't have Democrats in the South, and you don't have Republicans in the Northeast, you know, Connecticut Republicans, which the older Bush really was and exemplified. And there is, political scientists say that you're less likely to get a bipartisan foreign policy if you don't have political parties that are in all the regions. When they're in all the regions, the political parties have to come up with foreign policy ideologies that bridge the regions, which mean bridge the kind of conservative South and the liberal Northeast. If you don't have Republicans in the Northeast, you don't have to do that. And so you get not an America that's any more conservative or any more liberal, but it's more divided regionally, so the policy is less bipartisan. And that's really frustrating, because the median American thinker about foreign policy is no different than during the Cold War, but you don't have the electoral incentives to create policy that reflects that median voter. That's a problem. And so I think the Republican Party is going to have to do some soul searching and find some ways not to pander to what is a minority and ultimately a non-national interest driven position. And it means, and that's why I love America. I think America has been one of the greatest countries in providing order. You've heard my speech, but I would like to see this current administration not learn what would be a dangerous lesson, that is, you can win national elections by thumbing your nose at the international community and coming up with all this kind of anti-foreign, anti-French, anti-international community rhetoric. And I don't think sober analysts of the election think that that's what got Bush over the top, but the kind of public mythology about the election makes that seem like the next Republican is going to kind of want to do the same thing. And I think that's a problem.
I'll take one more question from down here, then I will come upstairs. Yeah, Chris Brown.
My question follows perfectly on from that, by chance, as it happens. I think that kind of partisanship is present elsewhere. If you think of redistricting in the Congress, for example, where incumbents are protected their own seats, which meant there are relatively few congressional districts now where you have to appeal to a mixed crowd, and of course that increases partisanship. Yet against that, the two most populous states in the Union, both of which are rock-solid Democrat, have Republican governors. What does that tell us? Does it tell us something about the role of the religious right? Because the characteristic of both these Republican governors is that they're unsound on religious values, radically so in Arnold's case, but George Pataki. Neither of them, despite the fact that they're remarkably successful politicians, neither of them would conceivably be Republican candidates next time, even if Arnold was constitutionally able to be, because the Republican Party wouldn't elect them. Is that what's happened to the Republican Party? That the group you were talking about, are they the Christian right that we're really talking about, rather than abstract intellectual groups like neocons or nationalists or whatever?
Yeah, that's a very good question, Chris, and I don't have a good answer. I have to think about it. I do think it is interesting those two states have Republican governors who are, you know, really, you know, kind of take roughly the same position that Clinton did in their policies. They do not, they are pro-choice. They would not be able to win elections in the South. Schwarzenegger is kind of a politician. I mean, a kind of polyglot politician. I mean, he's got a kind of amalgam. I have to tell you, I worked out with him once. I was at a hotel gym.
And
there were two of us. There were only two of us there, and I was this scrawny academic, and I had 20 minutes to kind of lift some weights. And there was one guy in the gym, and it was him. And I thought, oh God, this is going to be ridiculous. And the only thing I could think of to say to him was one of his lines from The Terminator, and I thought I better not say that because he'll probably slug me. And it wasn't "I'll be back," it was the other one. I think that the religious right is, you know, there's this remarkable correlation between, you know, white, male, church-going American and party identification and voting. And that kind of has regional kind of distribution that makes it difficult to imagine quite how the Democratic Party can reestablish some of its position in those countries. It's going to take very special politicians. There are examples going the other way. I think in Nevada there may be a Democratic senator. There have been some anomalies on the other side too, and those kind of anomaly types. And I think, you know, people like John McCain, who is is he pro-choice? I don't know, but he's got a kind of, he's definitely pro-science and R, and you know, he doesn't have this kind of anti-science kind of thing and anti-evolution. And so that's also in the party, and I think what I call that kind of national greatness Republicanism, and that's or conservatism, and that and they're big, you know, they're big government, you know, are not social conservatives. They have this other kind of American greatness kind of aspect to them. Defense, definitely. The Democrats will have a hard time because the Democrats have this problem I mentioned in my introduction, that they don't really take defense very seriously. And you saw Kerry painfully trying to cast himself as the national security candidate, you know, reporting for duty, and all of this, where in the audience, where the Democrats, you know, none of them have ever reported for duty. And, you know.
nor did the current president.
Yeah, I mean, well, that's the thing. That's, how did Kerry lose on that? It's kind of unfair in some sense. Bush could kind of make progress on that, but it's because it's the kind of pro-defense part of the country is primarily South. So even if a Democrat candidate can be tough on defense, Kerry was going to raise defense spending, create more divisions. Was going to be more defense oriented, but the pro-defense American constituency is also anti-abortion, primarily in the South. So there's pro-defense Americans have a hard time they can't see themselves in the Democratic Party because they have to, it's hard for them to take on the kind of liberal conservative social values, the liberal social values aspect of the Democratic Party. So there are multiple hurdles for the Democrats to win back that, to return to the days of Truman, JFK, democracy. There's a big I know I'm taking too much time on this. There's a big debate in Democratic circles. There's an article by the editor of the New Republic, Peter Beinhart, who's basically saying the Democratic Party has to do what the Democratic Party did in the 40s, which is purge the Henry Wallace pacifist.
Michael Moore.
Yeah, and Michael Moore. You got to get rid of Michael
Moore. Got to get rid of Michael Moore.
Kick him out. And and the others are saying, it's got to be, the anti-communism, it was a good move then, but now terrorism just isn't as monumental a thing justifies kicking out these lefties. But so the debate's going on. Mm.
I'll take a couple of questions because I don't want to be accused of balkanism. So we're getting on. Yeah, please. I'll take a couple together, actually, so we can move it along. Yeah, please. Yeah, you've got the mic in your hand.
Okay. If you can be brief. You presented liberal grand strategy in quite benign terms, but I wonder to what extent you concede that liberal grand strategies and indeed the attendant liberal discourses might in fact be productive, particularly in the developing world, as some of the resistances and the new threats that we see today, both in terms of democracy and civil society promotion and maybe in some key events of those periods you were mentioning, such as the way that the state of Israel was self-determined and recognized by the United States and humanitarian intervention in the immediate post-Cold War era.
Thank you. If you could pass it along to the gentleman here with his hand up. Yeah. So I'm bringing two or three, John, then let you sort of sum up. Yeah, please.
Do you agree with the argument that a Middle East peace deal could save America's legitimacy in the eyes of the world?
Right. Nice, short and sharp. There's one along here. Thank you. Yeah, pass along to your mate. Please.
Thanks for the lecture. It was quite enlightening, and I like the idea of the strategies outlining the strategies, liberal discourse and the conservative discourse. And I like the idea that neocons undersupply cooperation and oversupply resistance, whereas liberals oversupply cooperation and undersupply resistance.
Right.
But don't you think that is actually...
That's the lecture. What's the question?
The question is, don't you think that is actually both the strategies could be combined into one and both actually quite not so different in the post-Cold War era, where both actually serve the same master, and the master being the ideal of imperial Pax Americana. Don't you think in that regard, Republicans or neocons now, they're just more successful in serving the master? Well, Democrats are failing in that.
Okay.
That's the only difference, I think.
Right, fine. I will take one last question. I'll take one from over here, the chap with the brown jacket. I do know him. He's my PhD student, so I better let him have it because he'll give me a lousy report otherwise. Okay, Felix. Over to you. And I'll take this as the last question. I know there's other people with hands up, but I'm trying to... Felix, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. Very privileged, thanks. I have a question regarding your notion that there is a unipolar moment and that the United States is the one that is building or is in charge of building a new order. And I was just wondering if that is maybe a bit too America-centric. Because, I mean, if you look at Europe, there's a lot of order building on here in Europe. And, I mean, obviously during the Cold War that was connected. And I was basically wondering where you see that the disconnection has happened, where the split has happened, that the order building project between the United States and the European Union has gone two separate ways.
Okay, I'll take that as the last one and let John just sum up. And anything else you want to say, John?
That was a great question. All those were, and you've got a great advisor. So
Be kind. It's getting old.
Coming into this lecture, what I was most self-conscious about was that the implication of my talk for that issue, that it looks very, the vision is very unipolar, America-centered, and even my vision of a kind of liberal Leviathan, that is to say a kind of public goods provider, security provider, sort of underwriter of multilateral institutions, where the power component of America is subsumed, it is still a very much kind of a kind of Ptolemaic kind of vision of a kind of, you know, center and periphery and movement around and all this. And I don't quite know how to totally respond to that, except I do think that the U.S. is particularly in the security area is so critical. And that security relationships are ultimately the defining feature of international order, that I have to speak to that, even though I know, as John Mearsheimer, if you were here, and Joe Nye spoke in the David Held lecture last year, were here, they would say, you know, it's kind of, you know, it's not really unipolar in many different domains. But I still am convinced that the road forward is not a kind of multilateral global governance system where you have, you know, lots of great powers collaborating like a concert of Europe. I see the U.S. with key partners with agreed upon bargains and a kind of vision of a kind of loose rule-based order. And so that the linchpin continues to be a kind of set of bargains between the United States, which, even though it's not, in by some definitions, unipolar, it is the one country that can do the most damage by not participating. So I still think that the heart of the order post-Iraq and the strategies that have to be devised have to get at kind of these bargains between the United States and its partners, most importantly, Europe. And the European-American bargain, and this is where I'm partly here in London for a set of discussions about this with Timothy Garton Ash and others who have a vision where it's really a West. It's really a vision where it's not a unipolar America, it's a Western-centered international order. And what does that mean? And I'm very open to that. But it has to be built on bargains, explicit understandings about public goods, security has to be a component. So all of that takes me back to my basic logic. A couple issues on the Middle East. I think America does have a legitimacy crisis. I think, you know, the U.S. exacerbated that crisis, but it wasn't entirely caused by throwing its weight around Sharon and basically saying, giving Sharon a green light and not soldiering, probably without great success, but soldiering nonetheless towards a kind of broker deal. That shift has been a problem, and obviously Iraq made it worse. But if you, it's interesting. New public opinion debt, Zogby public opinion polls of the Muslim world, not just Arab world, but Muslim world, puts the U.S. Failure to put pressure on Israel to make a settlement as, even if Indonesian Muslims, it's really the issue. It has resonance, and the failure has, that the, it's not only America's failure, there's failure in among the Palestinians and certainly the Israelis, but it's not just America's failure to do something. That's too imperial a view. But the failure to at least try to be an impartial broker, I think, has made problems worse. And so I worry about that. I think that there's going to have to be kind of a reconfiguring of that, and it would make a difference. I'll just end by the first and the third question, really about new threats and strategies. And what I'm trying to figure out right now is how one can rethink and recharacterize this kind of liberal strategy that has a lot of realism in it, and one that maybe Europe would buy into as much as Americans would. And I'm trying to kind of re-identify that and go back to the 1940s. I found it very interesting that I've just been reading a little bit about the origins of the United Nations and how Truman was so taken by that. You think of Truman as this cold warrior who basically was a kind of power political calculator who was looking at the Soviet Union and being tough. Buck stops here and all of that. For 40 years, he carried around in his pocket Lord Tennyson poem, Lockersby Hall, which was a kind of ode to the world's common humanity. And he was a Wilsonian who was angry at the people who voted against the covenant and who were his first act the day after FDR died was in April 13th, his first act was to say, yes, the San Francisco conference would go forward for the charter drafting of the UN. And it was something he cared about deeply. Acheson, his right-hand man, who is arguably the architect of almost all of this stuff, was deeply skeptical of the UN. He thought that, what does the UN do? You know, one of his speeches in 1946, not against the UN, but about the UN, said, what does it matter if statesmen go to the UN to talk? You know, the old Arab proverb, an ass that goes to Mecca is still an ass. You know, a national interest position articulated in this marble laden hall is still going to be a national interest position. So what does the UN give you? So, but at Truman and Acheson together kind of melded the kind of realist and idealist or liberal vision, and that's very interesting. And I think that's where not just the past and the ideas that inform the current order fall, but a version of the two again in the 21st century. So that's where I'm putting my intellectual efforts, at the level of identifying ideas and strategies and visions of order.
Thank you very much, John. Well, six down, four to go. We've had six wonderful lectures, and we have four for next term. John mentioned the West, and indeed the very first lecture we have coming up on the 27th of January by Dr. Mary Cerotti. It's called The Death of the West, the U.S. and Europe in the Age of Bush. And I think that will address some of the... And I knew John was going to say that. That's why we organized the lecture by Mary to carry the series forward next term. The only piece of advice I'd give to John is don't go training with Arnold Schwarzenegger. Go and train with his twin, Danny DeVito. One of the greatest films of all time, I think. Or alternatively, come and train with me. And that would also reassure him about the state of his body by looking at mine. However, I'd like to thank John really profoundly. A thoughtful, critical, wise, and I always learn something when John speaks, and I hope you have too. And I hope we can all thank him in the usual manner. Thank you very much, John.